the brain, you know, goes into a new mode, starts something difficult and new, it really is taxing. So of course it's easier to go back to what's easy. And until it becomes automatic, the brain fights that because there's so much going on in the background. But if we will keep things up, we see not just emotional change and behavioral change, we see structural change at a brain level.
That was Kenneth Novak. He's a licensed psychologist living in Santa Monica, California, United States. He's the co-founder and chief research officer of Invisia Learning, an international consulting company dedicated to helping companies understand and develop systems for feedback and strategies to create behavioral change amongst professionals. He's the author of 2 books, numerous academic articles, and several book chapters, as well as editor-in-chief of Consulting Psychology Journal as part of the American Psychological Association. In addition to his other engagements, Dr. Novak has developed a platform called Talent Accelerator, a system to facilitate learning and behavior change. Through his years of work and research, he has developed an expertise in coaching psychology and feedback strategies. And on the side of his professional achievements, he volunteers raising guide service dogs for the blind, children on the autistic spectrum, and individuals with PTSD. Through life, his main driving force has been curiosity and an inner drive to continuously learn and grow. Today we talk about goal setting and what can help us move forward in achieving those goals. What are some hacks for success? How many goals should you work on simultaneously? And how long does it take to create and automate a new behavior? Welcome so much to the podcast. I'm really happy to meet you from these distant shores. How is it over there right now?
I'm actually we have a secondary house in the San Francisco Bay Area, so that's where I am now for a few weeks, and I'll be headed back to my primary residence in the beach in Santa Monica, California shortly.
So we're going to dive in. You have a lot of expertise and interest in learning, behavioral change, goal setting, and especially when it comes to teams and the workspace. So could you tell us a bit about how you became interested in your topic of research? What drove you into your field?
Yeah, our company, which is called Invisia Learning, is a global consultancy, and we really wear a cap as a technology provider. We design and develop platforms for collecting data. In other words, any assessment tools, be it team tools, 360, individual assessments. We've been doing that since 1984. And we also design and develop assessment tools targeted for leaders and individuals to really increase insight and awareness of their interests, their motives, their values, their personality, their skills. And the interest really to think about the research I've been involved in is how do we translate insight that people get from feedback into deliberate practice? And so the challenge, I think, in talent management today, leadership development, coaching, is how do we facilitate getting started? And more importantly, making that part of our DNA so it becomes automatic and part of our repertoire. And just sitting down with an individual and debriefing a personality inventory or attending a leadership experience doesn't necessarily translate to people going back to work and practicing it or it becoming more effective. So while globally we spend a great deal of money investing in the design and development of coaching and training programs, and there's limited evidence in terms of ROI at a behavioral level that we really see change that we want. So that's prompted us, for me individually as a researcher and psychologist, to really try to understand how do we get people started? How do we get them motivated? And how do we keep it up? How do we, in fact, get ROI in the kinds of programs and coaching training that we've been doing? So it's not entertainment. It truly becomes something that's a fabric of an ROI that's important for companies.
And so what do you see as the obstacle to this? Why are we inherently not already doing this? Why is it hard for us?
I think companies are interested in designing and delivering, and after that, it takes some effort and work at an organizational level to follow up, to evaluate. And we've all gone to webinars and conferences where it's much more looking at, did you like the food? Was the speaker well articulated? Did they seem to know their stuff? And certainly we use that type of evaluative data to refine and improve the program, but we're really not asking the other levels that are really critical. Are people motivated to want to do something with the information? Do we follow up later on to see if they've actually translated it into practice? And even more arduous is, do they keep it up over time? And that could translate into new behaviors. So it's sophisticated, and most companies don't have the time, money, and energy to really do the evaluation that they'd like to do. And that's sort of left to academicians and others that can come into a company and say, hey, I've got a bright idea. Let's see if we could follow some employees over time. Maybe control them to a group that's not gone through the training to really provide some evidence that what you're offering, a high potential program, a leadership program, really does have some teeth.
And so talking about motivation, goal setting, planning, learning new things, could you talk a little bit about how goal setting and goal achievement works when it comes to the psychological aspects?
Yeah, we really kind of divide it into two worlds, and it's a neuroscience type of division. We really talk about the getting started, the motivation side. And one of my idols in the research area, neuroscience heroes, is at the University of Oregon. His name is Elliot Berkman. And he's posited for a long time that really when we look at goal setting and goal striving, we're really looking at two overlapping but very distinct neural networks. And to get started on any kind of individual goal, we really have to have that readiness. It has to be, you know, concrete, specific. I could talk more about why it needs to be intrinsically motivating to stick with keeping it up over time. But that particular series of brain areas in that neuroscience network Elliot refers to as the will. He just has a cute little label for it. And it really is activating what's called the default mode network. And this is a network of interconnected areas of the brain that really fire, if you will, when we're not concentrating on doing a task. Maybe when we're daydreaming or out wandering to do a hike, or we get these bright ideas when we bathe or we're in the shower in the morning when we're really not focused on any specific activity. And these particular areas of the brain are quite unique and related to self-reflection and creative thought and acceptance to change and motivation to be ready. So when we talk about goal setting, we really have to have the infrastructures in place at a neural level of the brain being activated to be willing and interested and motivated to want to work on something. And then Elliot talks about the second type of neural structures is when we begin to put this into operation. And he calls it the way. And this really relates to goal planning and execution and the maintenance of goals over time. It's sort of the work that we do when we're focused and we're reflective, we're solving problems, or making decisions. And this is often referred to as the task positive network, a very, again, similar but overlapping but unique areas of the brain that light up when we're solving a math problem or thinking about what we need to do to overcome a barrier around a goal. So these are complementary areas of the brain that really occur at two different stages, if you will. Getting started and sort of the hacks and the neuroscience techniques of getting started are very different from keeping it up over time. My home in Los Angeles, I live at the beach in Santa Monica and really blessed to live just a very few thousands of feet from the beach. And I'm a runner, so each morning if I'm home and not traveling, I'm able to go out and go for my morning run. And I've been doing this since I moved to Santa Monica in 1994. It's just been, again, a habit. It's part of my routine. And I kiddingly refer to the people that I've seen since 1994 as part of Ken's Running Club. And my wife, who doesn't run with me anymore, but she used to when we started early, she does some other types of cycling and Pilates, etc. We would kiddingly say, hey, there's so-and-so. And we would make up a name, and I could come back home, and if she wasn't with me, I could say, well, there's FM Man, or there's, you know, somebody with a particular type of rollerblade, and she'll know immediately who it is. So this is a group that sometimes will pass each other and wave and nod and smile. And sometimes since 1994, there's no acknowledgement, but we both know that we're out there doing our thing. And these are people that cycle or skateboard, remember at the beach, electric bikes are really big now. And every New Year's, I love to go out if I can to break in the New Year with a New Year's run. And what I notice is people with brand new costumes, new outfits, the latest brands, and new equipment. So it could be a shiny new electric bike, or it could be, you know, brand new roller set of rollerblades that are high tech or whatever it is they're into. And my wife and I traditionally have always waited 90 days before we could nominate officially somebody into Ken's club. And I have to say that that club really hasn't expanded. It's contracted with people that I think probably have moved away from the Santa Monica area. But it's been a really good lesson of getting started as a whole set of neural processes and motivation. We all have great intentions, right, to translate what we want to do for the next year into a New Year's resolution. But again, I've found at a practical level 90 days later, very few people get to join my club. They've disappeared and I literally never see them again. So it's a good pragmatic illustration of what do we do in the world of work when we train somebody or we coach somebody and then we're done. It's, you know, attending a TEDx conference or a high potential seminar. And again, we bless people. They're excited about it. And we often just don't go back to follow up to see if anyone has done anything in terms of learning transfer.
So if they are still engaged after 90 days, then they have formed a form of habit or an engagement that is long term.
And there's some research evidence to support this magic number. There's a lot of myths out there of how long does it take to form neural circuits? How long does it take to form new habits? And we actually have good solid research that the brain begins after 6 to 8 repetitive practice sessions or repetitions to actually begin to wire in a particular way. If I were to blindfold you for 24 hours continuously, the brain begins to expect maybe you're gone blind. And we, in fact, start to neurally wire the occipital areas of the brain, which relate to vision, to the different areas of other senses. So our brain's pretty unique in doing that, and we do need deliberate practice that's long and hard enough. And research from Philippa Lawley, who's in London, is probably the classic study that looks at complicated behaviors. She used health, diet, and exercise as a great illustration. And what she found is, on average, it takes 65 to 90 days of deliberate practice before there's autotomicity. So we feel a comfort level. And the exercise I love to do with clients is a great illustration is to say, are you left or right-handed? And most people are right-handed. I'll say, well, write your signature and your name down with your right hand. Now stop. And I would like you to do it with your non-dominant hand. And they do it and they struggle a little bit and they're finished. And I ask rhetorically, well, what was that like? And they'll say, well, I really had to concentrate and I had to think about it. And oh my gosh, look at the quality of what I do naturally versus what I'm doing that's new. And it's a good visceral exercise to really illustrate that when the brain, goes into a new mode, starts something difficult and new, it really is taxing. So of course, it's easier to go back to what's easy. And until it becomes automatic, the brain fights that because there's so much going on in the background. As you and I are speaking now, you know, there's a wide variety of respiratory, neural, cardiac, a lot of systems that are going in the background naturally that if we had to think about it, we wouldn't be able to function. So until we develop that comfort level, until the brain again develops the neural synapses and neuroplasticity that we need to really make it comfortable, we fight it. It's real easy just to say, well, it's a little bit less sunny today at the beach. I think I'm going to take the day off from rollerblading. And that's what happens. And once we stop, again, the brain's like, okay, that was easy. And that becomes the new habit of not doing what we intended to do.
So after about a week, you see a running buddy, you go like, okay, this one is starting to sprout some new networks. So this could actually be something. We're going to keep an eye on this one. And you talked about inherent motivation instead of external motivation. How is this applied in the workplace when you work with teams that are often required to do a certain thing?
Well, the obvious answer is intrinsic motivation is in fact far superior than, you know, rewards and punishments. Extrinsic motivation to get people to do whatever you want. So aligning vision and mission and purpose and making sure people are doing work that applies on signature strengths always will, you know, facilitate people doing what you want them to do. And will actually do more. So all this debate about quiet quitting and the boundaries of work and life family. Well, if I don't like what I'm doing, it's real easy, particularly post-COVID, to say, you know, I'm going to draw the line and I'm not taking that email at night. I'm not going to take that call. I'm going to go back to what's important in life, family and hobbies and community and whatever you're into. But the more you're engaged, those boundaries break down. And we're a society now that, because of electronics, we're tethered 24/7. So if you're wearing an iWatch or you have a tablet or a smartphone, you can get pinged at any hour. And I'm a global company, so literally at 3, 4, 5 in the morning, if I pay attention, things are going off. And there's a demand characteristic of, yeah, you probably should return that call, or maybe it's a coach on a different time zone that really needs some information or some assistance. Well, that's why we have a team in place. But nonetheless, the point is that our brain really requires that kind of vigilance. So it's an interesting question. And like I say, that I think at the end of the day, we really have to work hard with teams to facilitate more intrinsic motivation than extrinsic. And interestingly, when we talk about rewards and punishments, there's some really cool research that comes out of the U.S. Patel, for example, has looked at getting people to set a goal of 7,000 walking steps during a day. And he set up two parameters. One is you could win a monetary reward if you met that goal, or we would actually take money from you if you didn't achieve the goal. And what he found, ironically, is that loss aversion is far stronger as an extrinsic motivator, that fear factor of, oh gosh, I'm going to lose something, than the pleasure and reward of what you gain by doing it. So it's not to suggest in a team we want to punish anyone, but we find that that's the way our brain is really organized, that our essential functions from an evolutionary perspective is to seek pleasure, which is great, and avoid pain. But that's far superior, the stronger motivation, and we call it the negativity bias. So we find that we can build that into the work that we're doing. And, you know, again, I wouldn't suggest punishment as any way to go. Far superior would be to find the sweet spot for employees to be really excited about what they're doing. And employees and organizations today are doing that. They're saying, what is the cost of working for a toxic boss or a team that we just don't get along, or an organization whose mission and vision doesn't align? So Twitter is a great example of CEOs that are demanding and asking things that some employees are willing to say, no, you don't have my soul, you don't have all of my energy in my life, I'll give you what the quid pro quo is of compensation and salary for a hard day's work and great quality, but after that I'm shutting down and shutting off.
So once you've found this inherent motivation to trigger a behavior, how do you maintain that motivation over time?
Yeah, there's a couple of hacks that I talk about in terms of keeping things going. And obviously sometimes we need some external support. So intrinsic motivation in and of itself is sufficient, but it might not get us where we need to go. So one of those is social support. And I like to talk about building in people in our life. It could be colleagues, it could be peers, it could be life partners, family members that will be our cheerleader, be our support. And by announcing our goals and building in that periodic checks where they're asking you, how are you doing? What progress have you made? In fact, Teresa Amabile, who's at Harvard, did a really interesting study that relates to this, asking people basically about their mental health and well-being at the end of a work day and the end of a work week. And she found that one of the most significant predictors was individuals that reported that they made progress towards whatever was on their task list, whatever their projects were. And for leaders just to sit down and ask an employee, what'd you do this week? What'd you get done? And when they say, wow, I was really frustrated, I ran into these barriers or these kinds of obstacles, for the leader to step in and say, well, let me see what I can do to help, you know, clean the ship here to make sure you can accomplish that. So support and social support can be that emotional support. It could be the instrumental support. But really checking in with people to say, you know, Maria, what have you done this week? How did it go? Have you stuck with whatever your goal would be, you know, whether it's weight loss or exercise or whatnot, for you to say, well, you know, it was, again, a non-sunny day and I just didn't exercise. For me to be encouraging to say, what would it take for you to get out there? So that's one of the things we can build in, and we do find in organizations that peer support and peer coaching can be really valuable as a way of not just getting people excited, but keeping it up. And because we're social creatures, another technique that's used is social comparison. So we see a lot of social media and ways of comparing, you know, who's accomplished their goals. And it's intrinsically kind of firing us up in our competitive mode to say, well, Maria did 2 more days of exercise than I did today. And I've seen that and it's visible. I'm going to try to match her next week. So that's another technique that companies and organizations and individuals can do. When I run, the only time I really wear my Apple Watch is not really to tell time, it's just to keep track. And I'm a creature of habit. I run the same direction, the same amount of time, the same distance. Time has been much slower over the last few years as I age, but the point is I keep doing it. And intrinsically motivated is just to take a look at how I'm doing relative to the other people that are willing to share their time and their effort and frequency of exercise. And again, I look at it and it's sort of silly, but I say, oh, I got my 5 days a week in today of what I do every day, and that's intrinsically motivating. So that social comparison can be pretty powerful to keep going. There's a lot of other hacks I could talk about as well, but one has to do with setting goals themselves. And we do find that to really execute goals over time, we have to really have two pieces to a goal. And the first is sort of a trigger or a cue, and then the definition of what I want to do. And a lot of us have great intentions, again, go back to New Year's resolutions, but they're actually really terrible predictors of long-term and sustained behavior change. So just announcing, I'm going to work out a new year more frequently, and even if you could be precise, doesn't really translate into people keeping it up. They're not going to be in my club.
The gym is filled in January.
Yeah, we refer to this as what's called academically implementation intentions. It's different from a goal intention. You know, I want to lose weight, I want to work out, I want to manage stress better, I want to be more kind and sweet to employees. All sounds good, nothing ever happens. Intentions really have two pieces, a cue, a trigger. An example might be if I'm a leader in an organization, I've been given feedback that I dominate in meetings. And I cut people off and I'm kind of defensive. And I tried that on and say, you know, I need to work on that. I want to be more participative, which a lot of leaders need to take a look at. The question is, how do I get somebody to practice something that's concrete over and over? So just sharing with me, and again, in an executive coaching session that, yeah, I want to be more participative or involvement oriented. It's like, great. So what are you going to be doing more, less, or differently? So an implementation intention really has two pieces, and I use what's called if and then. And if is the cue, it's the trigger, it's the situation. And I might say, well, how often do you meet with your team? And they'll say, well, I meet weekly. And I go, great. Then let's translate that to what will you actually be doing more, less, or differently? And that's what we need to be kind of concrete and specific to say, well, I'm going to ask Maria's idea first before I share my own. Okay, well, that's great. If you do that, you'll be perceived as more involvement-oriented than just monopolize the entire meeting. That's one of the hacks that we take a look at in terms of creating goals, is to use implementation intentions and really fire people up to say, we can be concrete, but I need a trigger. You know, can I pair that with something that's already existing? Maybe I want to, again, practice gratitude or mindfulness meditation. If I could pair that with another activity, like waking up in the morning and I have a routine, pairing that with that, I could brush my teeth or be in the bathroom and comb my hair and think of one or two things I'm grateful for. And if I can repeat that and that can become automatic, I now have created the if, that's the situation, the cue, and that's the behavior that if I can do it long and hard enough, we actually would see change at a neural and a behavioral level. So those are cool things we can do to keep things going using social media comparison, using social support, and the way we structure goals and other ways of rewards and intrinsically focusing on what we're doing can keep us going for at least 90 days or more.
So when we stack things the way that you described, that if I have this, then I'm going to do that, is there kind of a normal best before date that we do this for a certain amount of time and then we tend to forget? So we enter that situation and we don't remember to do it. We forget the cue.
Yeah. Well, again, that's where the cue is so important. If I were to say to you, did you brush your teeth this morning? You'd probably say, yeah, I did, because that's an existing habit. So I like to encourage people to pair new behaviors with those that exist so we don't forget. And I think, again, adherence in the medical field to medication is what drives physicians crazy. If you're hypertensive or have high cholesterol, and we say, well, we've got this little white pill, but you need to take it every day. And you go back and you say, oh, Maria, did you know your cholesterol's still high? And you go, yeah, I know. I haven't been very vigilant to take that. So pairing something with a new behavior with something that's simple, that exists, is easier than creating a new routine. And again, the brain really fights new routines because it's like writing your signature and giving your autograph with your non-dominant hand. Gosh, that takes energy. And if I don't have to do it, back to what's natural, what's really easy.
So what are your thoughts on mental obstacles to creating new habits? A lot of people start exercising, but seem to have some form of obstacle to continue with it more than just remembering it.
Yeah, and again, I would go back to the social comparison, social support, and making sure your goal is simple. That's one of the basic fallacies in what we attempt to do in life is don't start out and say, I want to run a marathon. Let's go for a walk for 20 minutes at a pace that's comfortable. And again, continue to do that. And if you want to escalate the goal to something a little bit more complicated, it's a graded way of increasing readiness to change. So we find that sometimes the difficulty of goals doesn't work. One of the books and one of the goal gurus, behavior and habit change gurus that I really like is based here in the United States at Stanford University. And like Atomic Habits, in that book, he's written a best-selling book called Tiny Habits. And he uses his first two initials and his last name is Fogg, B.J. Fogg. And he talks about the difference between the difficulty of a goal versus people's inherent want to focus on it. If it's an easy thing to do, we all will do it. If it's hard, we find that it takes tremendous energy and infrastructure to keep it up. So the reference to tiny habits is really cut those habits down into sub-goals or micro-goals. And there's another really strong reason for considering this, and we know intuitively that no matter what we do in life, when we first get fired up, New Year's, go back to that as a great example, we're excited. We want to do it, right? We want to bring our new costume out and go walking and enjoy the beach and the sun. And so that's kind of exciting for a few days. But we also find towards the end of a project, and it could be an academic project, a work project, again, we're really excited about seeing the end of that particular bridge and the tunnel we're going through. So the ending of a task is intrinsically motivating. But research from Eilert Fishlett and others at the University of Chicago have really indicated the obvious that the middles of no matter what we set up to do are kind of arduous. We become a slacker. We lose motivation. So one of the tips and hacks that she suggested I really am a big advocate for is creating shorter middles. So making those goals and tasks tinier and making sure that the time period that we're doing things is a lot shorter and truncated, and that really allows us to stay fired up throughout that activity. So some practical things that, again, we shoot for the moon too often. And again, it's like in coaching, I really say to people, well, that's too complicated. Let's look at what the precursor, the antecedent is for the longer term or more difficult goal. Let's start it and make it simple. And that are, you know, ingredients for being more successful in starting and maintaining habits. So again, we call it the shorter middle. So I'm more excited longer because I'm not looking at this arduous endpoint of running a marathon. I see it as, you know, is it realistic you can go out a few days a week for 15 or 20 minutes? Yeah, I think I can do that. So with that, we can build on that to say, okay, well, can you go longer? Let's do, you know, a month later, a longer goal. Can you do it for 60 minutes? Well, I've done 15 minutes without much of a challenge, and I haven't really stopped, so that's okay. So one point, too, I want to raise, too, is I don't know if you've been raised the way that I have or anyone else, but I know growing up, my parents would always hammer very hard, if you start something, don't stop it. In other words, don't give up. It's sort of this work ethic of work hard, work long, you'll run into obstacles. Don't be a quitter. That was the message, that quitters are weak. And so we have a mindset, and I think parents add to this, and we've actually found now research that that actually is not true. With unattainable goals, we can kind of visually hit our head against the wall and not be successful, yet we keep trying, and we try and try again, and it really evokes a sense of failure and a loss of self-efficacy and self-confidence. And there's a couple of researchers, Rush and Miller, who have done some pretty startling research that says sometimes giving up is not only the better way to go, but it actually relates to our physical health. And in some controlled studies, they looked at individuals that weren't successful in reaching some very challenging, too difficult, unattainable goals, and found that those that were willing to redirect and redefine, they quit, but they framed it differently. They looked at something that was a little bit more narrow. They had a significant decrease in a very important inflammatory marker called C-reactive protein, and a decrease in cortisol. So I think, again, we want to be encouraging that when people run into a brick wall, don't keep pushing them and tell them you got to keep it up. It's redefining. It's looking at, again, what would make this simpler? What would make it easier? And go back to that to see if that'll help you to sustain it over time.
So it's not necessarily to completely give up on the goal that you have. It could be to scale it back and see, am I moving too fast? Am I expecting too much? Should I do this in a different way or in a different pace?
Yeah, exactly.
When do you know that you should completely give up? Like, I shouldn't be doing this at all. I'm just going to go, this is not for me.
Well, I think Rosha Miller really highlighted that as well, as to say sometimes we can't do what we wanted to do. When I was a young adolescent in high school and college, my goal was to play a professional sport in the United States, baseball. And I actually went to a university that at the time had non-scholarships, and I played 1 year. And the coach came up to me, and I'll never forget it, in a very polite way. He said, Ken, I love your passion. I love your motivation. You practice, you know, probably harder than anyone. But we have something here on campus that's probably a better fit for you. It's called intramurals. And he was jokingly really suggesting that, you know, my DNA and my skill set point had reached its capacity, and that my dream of that kind of capacity, I just wasn't going to be able to do it. So I had to abandon that goal. And of course, I was always active and continued to play the sport. It was intramural. So I would play with a group that was non-competitive, not part of the college team. So I think it's realistically redefining what we're doing. And yeah, I'm not playing professional baseball in the United States and never did. But I still love the game. I still like to play even at my age with a group of men that go out every couple of months, and I can enjoy it. So there are times we look at our career, we look at our life, that we have this mindset of don't quit. Quitting is failure. Quitting means that I'm less than 100%. But I go back to Rosha Miller's research to say, you know, sometimes it's not a bad thing to do. And from a mental health perspective, we actually are healthier getting out of a toxic relationship, an abusive relationship, an unfulfilling relationship, or working on tasks that are intrinsically just not exciting. I have a lot of clients that are professionals, whether it's law or medicine, and they're very dissatisfied with life and their professional career. And I always ask the same question of, well, when did you get in touch with this not being a great alignment and fit? Pretty much I get the same answer, which is either the first or second day of law school or medical school, but they've now got sunken cost, or because the parents were very much pushing a prestigious degree, or they were in the same profession, they felt this obligation of, I've got to continue in the track of someone in my family.
But they knew from the start that they didn't feel this was for them.
Quitting at that point, once you've gone through 4 years of, you know, medical school and then 8 years of training, you kind of go, wow, I don't know how to get out of this. But again, there's some great research that really suggests that might be a time to reevaluate. And there's nothing to be ashamed of, or you're not a failure, you're not less of a person for doing it. You may actually be wiser to, you know, reframe, redefine, go in a different direction.
Self-awareness and course correction.
Yeah, good point.
So what are some other kind of hacks for setting goals and maintaining goals?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I think, you know, what's so interesting is the brain science of keeping things up over time. I'll share just a couple of studies that are just mind-boggling interesting. In the UK, you probably know that the London taxi cab drivers have to take this arduous test called the Knowledge. And they have to kind of memorize every nook and cranny, even today, of every street in London. And they don't have the fortunate opportunity that I have of asking the person on my phone that, by the way, no matter where I go, always says recalculating. There's a couple of researchers, Woollett and colleagues, that brought in London cab drivers that have been doing this for a while and used functional MRI to take a look at what's going on at a brain level. And as you would imagine, they have enlarged areas of the brain, the posterior hippocampus, that's related to spatial intelligence and spatial relations. And it's actually expanded relative to people that do any other occupation. So that's not too surprising, but they did a couple of follow-up studies with individuals who are now retirees. And they actually did the same thing, brought them into a lab, took a picture of the brain. And what they found is after stopping doing what they did professionally, there was still an enlargement relative to a house painter or somebody that would do another occupation, but it had shrunk dramatically. So we do find again that even things like mindfulness meditation, Tanya Singer at Max Planck Institute in Berlin has done great research really suggesting that if we will keep things up, we see not just emotional change and behavioral change, we see structural change at a brain level, shrinkage of the gray area in the amygdala. Other areas that relate to empathy pathways in the brain can be actually stimulated, and they wire together. So again, not surprising, doing things causes this label of neuroplasticity. The brain is really good. As we say, neurons that fire together begin to wire together. It's that automaticity that's important.
Do we know anything about how often we need to do something? Is it daily, once a week? Do we know anything about how seldom can we do something and still see change happening?
Yeah, I wish I could share any current research that really illuminates that. There's no really concrete research, and I'm willing to argue that it's specific to the behavioral change that we want. So if you want to be a better active listener, that's going to be a little different than if I want to work out, or again, if I want to be caring and empathetic in my interactions with others, or I want to be more participative in meetings with my team. So I think there'll be some variance of how often do I need to repeat things, but we do need that constant, do it sometime, some amount of time, for a period of 45, 65, 95, 90 days, and in order for the brain to really form the wiring that makes us feel comfortable and for people to notice there's an improvement in what we're doing.
Do you have any thoughts on how many different behaviors we can change at the same time?
Well, this is a good question. It goes to the point of how many goals, in a way, can I work on simultaneously to be effective? And there's new research from Wilson and colleagues here in the United States that actually suggests two or three goals simultaneously maximizes success. So if we're looking at New Year's resolutions again, I might say, well, just pick one thing. And that's often the common argument of do one thing and one thing only. But their research actually suggests that it's an inverted U-curve where 2 to 3 maximizes success. Anything more than that, it's not going to work really as effectively. And even 1 is less effective than a couple. And it may be that we could focus on both of those or 2 or 3 simultaneously with the ingredients that go into social support, social comparison. And of course, if we're not intrinsically motivated, it doesn't matter what those are. So it's a really great question. And from a pragmatic perspective of coaching with clients, again, I kind of, when I started, would say, let's just look at one thing and really work hard on that. Now today, I'm kind of encouraging people to set a couple of goals that they're really fired up and excited to do simultaneously that we can come back to in each session and say, hey, Maria, how did you do on this one? And how'd you do on the second one that you've been working on?
But why is that? Why is 2 or 3 better than 1? Is it because we remember it? Because we have more different time points when we're supposed to do something new? Or is it that we feel that we're changing a lot?
They really kind of argue again at a brain level that one thing and one thing only, as we've mentioned, we may lose the motivation or we may forget to do it. But having a couple of things, a couple of balls up in the air really enhance our metrics around being vigilant about what we're doing, nudging ourselves. So it gives us 2 reference points or 3 reference points rather than a single one that we could relapse on or minimize the significance of the goal. So if there's only one thing I want to do in a New Year's resolution, it's really easy, and we do find that people give it up pretty dramatically. But I have a couple, and it gives me this opportunity to, you know, again, focus on both of those at the same time. And if one gets dropped, I can go back and really work on the other as well. So a really good question. I don't think, again, Wilson was that specific as to the why. They were really looking at how many sort of maximize success and effectiveness over time.
So how do you know when to switch one of those? Let's say that you have 2 or 3, and now you pass this 90 days. It seems like it's more of a habit. When is it safe then to, okay, I'm going to put this other thing on now, so that's going to be in my group of goals because this one is now working for me?
Well, if I go back to, again, neuroscience, I really want to get you to the point where it feels automatic and it becomes kind of your DNA. And again, for me, kind of complicated behaviors, it would be a 3-month, 90-day period to say, hey, Maria, now that you're working on this, do you want to refine it or do you want to just keep it up? So we would check in, of course, with you a little bit later on, but that would be the point that it'd really begin to transition to a new goal. So one of the things we've designed and developed is a platform in our company for habit change and learning transfer, and we call it Talent Accelerator. And it's built on some of the science that we've been talking about today. And every 30 days, with your individual goal, it could be leadership, it could be interpersonal, we'll actually send you an email and nudge you to say, hey, how are you doing? And we'll ask a very quick question or two around, have you made progress? Again, with the idea that progress is the single best predictor of feeling good about yourself and what you're doing. And at the end of a 90-day period, we actually automatically send out a pulse survey to anyone in your life. It could be, again, a life partner, a peer at work, a colleague, your boss. And they would tell you, hey, are you still dominating meetings? Are you still cutting people off? And that would be the point I'd sit down with you to say, well, how do you think you're doing? And you'd say, well, I think I'm doing really well. And I say, okay, well, let's take a look at the pulse survey from a couple of your team members. And they're all going, well, yeah, I think she needs to keep working on this. So we would revisit that for another 90 days, say, let's refine it. Let's look at another kind of aspect of behavior. And maybe we want to teach you now to rephrase what you've heard again before you share out your great points of wisdom. And that may be a way of actively listening, another message that you're really tuning in, you're really participative, and you really care about the points of others. And I'd wait another 90 days with you to say, let's look at the feed forward to see if you've improved in that, to tweak that goal, or let's go to another goal that also came up in our coaching work that you need to work on, whatever that would be. So I would use that as sort of a rough time period to say, when do we modify, edit, or insert a new goal? And again, if you're working at a couple simultaneously, one you may keep up and another you might say, gosh, I feel pretty good about maintaining this. Let's go define another thing I could work on because I'm really excited to grow and develop professionally and personally.
So using this social support is very important then.
Critical.
It's a reminder, it's accountability, and it's support. It can help you see objectively what you're doing. It can ask you again, what is your motivation? What is your interest in this? What is it you're trying to achieve and why? And if it's not working, can we talk about why it's not working and help you to get back on the horse or redirect, as you say? But 30 days, is that enough? Or does it have to, let's say that you would do this yourself and you have a family member.
Yeah. Well, I would say every 30 days, you know, get some goal partners. We call them goal mentors. And again, they could be individuals that you just contract to say, text me in the end of this month. What's going on at the end of December? And say, did I do whatever I claimed I'm going to do? And they could be a real support. And you look at your smartwatch or your phone and kind of go, nah, I haven't been doing it. I don't know how to tell them this, but I've got to respond to that request that, no, I didn't go out for my committed walk every couple of days during this week. I had really bad weather, or whatever the excuse is. So tremendous power of social support.
So have you, in your experience, seen, let's say somebody starts something, they give up after a week, you have a reminder after 30 days, you go like, yeah, no, I didn't do it. You get back on the horse, you start doing it again. How many times do people stop before it slowly grows into a more continuous change?
Yeah, it depends how intrinsically motivated you are to begin with and whether the goal is too hairy and audacious. But that would be what I would go and dig in with my clients or a friend to kind of say, well, was this realistic? Why did you pick, I'm going to walk 10K 2 days a week? Well, that's a noble goal. But again, why don't we do something that's tinier, something that's smaller? And did you really want to do that? And they're like, well, no, but Maria's doing it. So I thought that would be a good thing to copy what she's doing. So this is where I would go and challenge people to say, you know, let's make it realistic. Let's make it personal. Let's make it something that you can attain. And you're more likely to keep it up over time.
How do you know how difficult is difficult enough? Because it needs to be challenging, but it should not be too hard. How do you find the sweet spot?
Well, it's up to you and depends on, again, very context specific to what you're working on. And most of us overshoot, so I'm always backing off that to say, well, can you do a little bit less and be okay with that? People are like, oh, sure, that's real simple to do. And I like to have them start there. It's like, okay, let's do that. Back off what your grand goal was, and we'll build up to that. And most people are like, okay, I'm willing to do that. So I find that as a strategy pretty helpful, rather than, again, going for the gold and brass ring that we all think is the gold standard of, well, if Maria can do it, I can do the same. And we're all built differently, right? Different personalities, different DNA, different genetic predispositions. So it's very individualistic and it's very hard to generalize to every human on earth. This is the amount of time you need to stop something and then start it again in order for it to be a success. And it may be different again, depending on the kind of goal that you're working on.
So it should feel challenging, but not overwhelming.
Yeah, I think that's the key. And when things are intrinsically motivating, what you perceive to be challenging is just seen as something that I feel in control of. So there's a psychological construct, and we actually have a measure of this called hardiness. And we find that people have a mindset that what they elect to do is based on their ability, their motivation, rather than luck or God's will. And they're excited about it, and rather than seeing this as something that is an agony to have to go through. So we find that people have this hardy mindset that will allow them, when there's challenges, when there's obstacles, when there are barriers, to get back and redo it. And they'll explain their failures in a way that says, well, that was something due to external factors. It's pretty temporary, and it's not me. It's the situation and environment that I'm in.
So to sum up, we're closing into the new year. For people who would like to go at it with New Year's resolution, what would be your top three advice to start something and actually have it change something during the coming year?
Well, first is, again, to find something that's small, concrete, doable, that you want to do. And it probably isn't something that you set last year out to do. So, again, a tiny habit. Second is to engage a social support network to announce what you're doing and engage them as a goal mentor and partner to help you to be successful. So maybe if you want to go out for a walk 2 days a week, I say, hey, Marie, would you want to go with me? And you go, oh, I don't know, I wasn't thinking of doing that, but if I can get you to do it, and I have a partner that when I'm feeling like I'm kind of tired today, Maria's like, nope, we're going to go. I'm coming over. I'll pick you up in 15 minutes. So that'd be a second thing I would concretely say. And again, use this if-then methodology of goal setting. Need a trigger, need a cue, and that could be a place, a situation, a time of day. You know, if it's Monday and Wednesday, at 7:30 in the morning after dropping my kids off to, you know, class or school, I'm going to park and go to the nearby park that's a public park. I'm going to walk for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'm going to go back home. So pairing, again, a habit with an existing behavior can be a really way of keeping that up. So there'll be a couple of hacks that I'd really encourage anyone listening today to try on and think about. But behavior change is hard. And if it was that easy, I wouldn't be talking to you about it, and we wouldn't all challenge ourselves in the world of work to say, how do we get leaders to do something more, less, or different? And I'll kind of leave it too that I used my example of my end goal of being a professional baseball player. Some of us, however motivated we are, can't really bend and change as much as others would like us to. So we need to be realistic in behavior change to think about what's the magnitude of change that's realistic for any one individual. And I call it a skill set point. Think of it as a spring that even if I'm sufficiently motivated, maybe you have more innate capacity to become better and improve more than I would. So that's one of the questions we ask a lot in coaching is, okay, you want Ken to be non-directive and non-controlling and participative. He's interested in getting coaching, but his personality is one that's really kind of directive and authoritative. Is that really going to be the magnitude of change, even with coaching and enthusiasm to work with a coach, that you think you're going to get? So we need to be realistic as well. And in life, we can't always get what we want, but we can attempt to move in a direction. And doing things over and over for a period of time won't make you expert, it'll make you better.
And then maybe find value in what you have instead. If you find that change is actually not for me in this particular area, what do I already have? How can I see that as valuable, or how can I use that to my benefit in a different way than the way I absolutely wanted it to be? This has been very interesting. So I would just like to thank you from all of my heart for taking the time to come here and share your knowledge and your experiences. And it's been a great pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me.
Here are some takeaways from today's interview. Research has shown that it normally takes between 65 to 90 days of deliberate practice to create automaticity in a new habit. Until the new behavior becomes comfortable, we have a tendency to fight it. The friction becomes too much to deal with, in addition to everything else we got going on in life. But one of the most efficient ways of maintaining motivation and achieving goals is actually social support. To have someone like a family member, a colleague, or a friend that can be both your cheerleader, someone to brainstorm solutions with, and a source of accountability. To execute goals, there are two important aspects: having a cue to know when to perform the new behavior, and a plan on what to actually do. Setting a so-called implementation intention is an effective way of creating the structure needed to keep going. So the first thing you need is the cue, a trigger, something you already regularly are doing automatically to trigger you to remember to also do your new habit. And then you need to define what you're actually going to do more, less, or differently than before. If and then is a way of thinking about this. If this happens, then I will. So for example, if I brush my teeth, then I will practice gratitude by thinking of a few things I'm grateful for. We often want to make big and fast changes in life. But when it comes to actually pulling through and achieving something, the goal needs to be feasible to do. One way to do this is to divide a larger goal into sub-goals or micro-goals to make it less daunting. We're also more motivated at the beginning of and near the end of achieving a goal, making the middle the hardest part to keep up. So shortening the middle is a way of increasing the likelihood that we will keep going. We're often taught that we should persevere and never quit on something we started. Turns out the research on this says that it's better to know when to actually quit. Sometimes the things we set out to do are unattainable or just not good for us. And then it's much better for our mental and physical health to just say no and redirect or redefine. Working at 2 to 3 goals simultaneously maximizes success. Working on one goal alone is surprisingly enough less effective than working on 2 at the same time. It's easier to lose motivation or forget about the goal when there is only one. And when we have more than one, we have more reference points. So when you feel like the habit is automatic, it's time to start asking yourself if you just want to maintain it or if you want to refine it. If you choose maintaining, then this would be the time to consider adding on a new goal to work on. Thank you for tuning into this episode. I hope it gave you some great hacks and interesting info that you can use in your day-to-day life. If you're curious and want to know more, take a look at the website brainobservations.com and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. See you next time.